For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Positively Trek. I'm Barry, here with the illustrious Dan, and I'm really excited for this episode. This has been something of a episode in the making on my end for some time. I've got some background and some context to give about this a little bit later as we get going, but we as Trek fans will sometimes find ourselves linking our beloved franchise to other ways of telling interesting exploration tales. And most people will know that Star Trek has its influences from such sailing epics like Horatio Hornblower and so on. And so in this respect, we are looking at the wonderful 2003 movie Master and Commander, Far Side of the World, starring Russell Crowe and directed by Peter Weir in what I would argue to be probably one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek of all time. Dan, what would you think about us going down this path and basically claiming this movie as sort of a surrogate of Star Trek fandom?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this has been kind of a longstanding joke for sure that Master and Commander is the second best Star Trek movie ever made. the first of which, of course, being Galaxy Quest.
Well, so. Of course.
No, yeah, we have this tendency to kind of, is the Federation expansionist or is the Star Trek franchise expansionist? Are we claiming territory on behalf of Star Trek? And Star Trek has its roots in a number of different things, the science fiction serials of the 30s and 40s. But also a big part of that is naval tradition and stuff, right? Like Gene Roddenberry said, Horatio Hornblower was a big model for what Star Trek is and what some of the characters are. And Master and Commander, I remember watching this pretty close to 2003. I'm not sure when exactly I saw it, but I remember thinking like, oh, this is Star Trek, but on the seas, which is ridiculous because Star Trek is naval combat and stuff, but in space. That's the way it actually is. But, to a young Star Trek fan, it's everything's through that lens, right? So
I agree. I also think that Sir Patrick Stewart really does hammer that home as well. And then obviously the starting of Star Trek Generations, where they're throwing each other overboard and all that sort of stuff, right? All decked out in their lovely Royal Navy blues of the period too, right? They would have literally been pretty much, I'd say, the Napoleonic era. This movie, just for anyone who hasn't watched it, there are going to be a ton of spoilers here. This movie came out 22 years ago, so please just get it. I don't know what to tell you other than if you haven't seen it, it would bear stopping listening and actually watching the movie because it is fantastic. But
it is well worth a watch. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
If you haven't seen it in a while too, seriously, what a better way to spend, we're having some horrible weather right now. Winter has come back and it is just dreadfully cold. Very similar to what they would have experienced going around Cape Horn. So I'm going to do a very quick and dirty recap of the entire movie, so people kind of know what's going on and what's going down. So first of all, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, is actually an amalgamation of several novels that were written in the 1950s and 60s, if I remember correctly, about a fellow by the name of Captain Jack Aubrey. And he was based off of a actual historical naval captain who would have actually been around this time. I think he fought at the Battle of the Nile, the Battle of Gibraltar, if I remember correctly, or he missed it by just that much. His name was Captain Thomas Cochran. He would later go on, the historical captain would actually later go on to be a member of Parliament and end up in a corruption scandal, which is funny because at one point Captain Aubrey says that finding the enemy ship that they're looking for, the Acheron, would be like finding an honest man in Parliament. So I wonder if there was a little bit of a connection there. So Jack Aubrey, his beloved doctor, and not first mate, but definitely a beloved member of the crew, Stephen Maturin, are out on the north coast of Brazil. And what they're doing is they are chasing down a French privateer. A privateer is basically a ship that has been given letters of marque to attack enemy ships on behalf of the king, and they would get to keep a certain amount of the spoils. Well, they get caught and pretty much bested, you could say, by this mystery ship, the Acheron. They then have to refit at sea as they head south down the coast of South America, when again this ghost ship comes up from behind them, attempts an attack again, but they manage to outrun them into the nighttime. They actually do a historically accurate move where they set out a decoy ship made out of barrels and sails, and manage to get the drop and come back around and chase the Acheron around the most dangerous seas in the world, the southern coast of South America, known as Cape Horn. It just spawns hurricanes, folks. It's a crazy part of the sea. Interesting fun fact, the frigate that they actually bought as the Surprise, which is the ship that Captain Jack Aubrey is on, actually sailed that all the way around the south, and some of the footage is real footage that they took of the waters around Cape Horn. So that's a neat little bit. They wind up at the Galapagos Islands, where Dr. Steve Maturin, who is a bit of a naturalist, is super, super excited to go around and look at all the cool bugs and iguanas and everything else, but sadly, doesn't work out. The Acheron shows up again, and they've got to go see if they can catch it, causing some issues between the captain and his beloved friend and doctor and naturalist on board. We're going to get into that in a little while. They wind up in the doldrums for a little while, which is a giant Pacific gyre, get stuck there, almost die, find their way back. Some injuries ensue, but they wind up back at the Galapagos Islands only to find the Acheron once again, but this time they get the drop on them using a tactic where they disguise their ship like a whaling vessel. They manage to bring the Acheron in close, as of course the Acheron is a privateer, would love some of that tasty, sweet, sweet whale oil. Of course, it would be worth as much as crude oil today. But unfortunately for the Acheron, the Surprise gets the Surprise and attacks back. And there we have the final battle of the movie. So there's a quick little dirty recap on the whole meal deal. First things first, this takes place during the Napoleonic era. The actual books don't take place at that time. Most of this book was actually based on when the Surprise was actually fighting an American ship during the War of 1812, interestingly. But they had to move it back to not anger the American audience and make the Americans the bad guys. The long and short of it that I want to basically just kind of get started from here is, you know, overall thoughts of the movie. What really stood out to you, Dan? What are some things that really made you excited to watch this movie again? Because you were able to come over, bring a multitude of potato chips, and we enjoyed the viewing. So what's some stuff that really stuck with you just before we start delving into all the aspects of this movie?
Well, I think one of the things, and we'll definitely talk more in detail about some more specific stuff, but generally overall, I love the naval feel of this movie and how you're kind of dropped in the middle of it and you don't really get a primer of like naval terms or anything like that. You're just kind of dropped in the middle of it and expected to kind of keep up. In a lot of ways, it reminded me of something that Gene Roddenberry said about Star Trek, which was that he wanted audiences to feel like you're just dropped in this world. I think specifically he said, if a police officer in a police procedural pulls out his revolver, he doesn't stop and explain how a revolver works. No. Right? So Captain Kirk pulls out his phaser. It's a gun. Like, you're in this world and you should know it. And you're just expected to keep up. This is everyday life. This isn't galloping galaxies, whiz bang stuff. This is the real world. And in this movie, you're dropped into a 19th century Napoleonic era battle, and you're in that world. Things like Harda Larboard, right? Yeah. I feel like there was probably a discussion in the writer's room or at some point. Should we just say port? People will understand Harda Port better than Harda Larboard. And it's like, mm-hmm. No, at this time, that term didn't exist yet. It was larboard and starboard. Mm-hmm. We're going to use the right terminology, and people can just keep up. And yeah. I really like that.
I echo that. And right at the beginning there, I always think about when Mr. Hollum is looking out and they hear something. It sounds like a bell, right? So they say native fishermen, perhaps, and then maybe it's a reef marker. And immediately he turns, Mr. Calamy, the lead, if you please, right? He dropped that lead scoop that's going to drop down. We're going to see how deep the water is below us and if there's a reef down there. And so they pull it out, you know, 5 fathoms, right? And then sand and broken shell, right? It's all that just really quick back and forth stuff, right? When the captain comes out, where away, right? What are you saying? Like, I do have to say this movie lends itself to the subtitles. Definitely. You could get lost in some of the things that they're saying, but you're right. That immersive sort of thing really pays off later when they start singing sea shanties and you kind of got the feel for it. You got your sea legs now and you really feel those moments better because there's an authenticity to it. And I think good Star Trek does that as well, right? When they're, you know, telemetry indicates blah, 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 blah. That's sand and broken shell.
The technobabble. It's the inverse of the technobabble.
Yeah. Inverted technobabble, which is something that I think we as Trek fans really will gravitate towards, because it is like, oh, this is business as usual, right? These guys, like, their training is kicking in, and that's something I think we, again, as Trek fans really enjoy, is when it looks like the people we admire know what they're doing. And that's a good one. I like that, the immersive nature of it all just really pulls it together. Yeah. I would say that one of the big things that sort of stands out to me in this is the turns of phrase all the way through. And one of my favorite parts is when the Acheron is behind them. They don't know how it got there, but it's chasing them and they're in a lot of trouble. They realize that there's a pretty high possibility that that ship is going to catch them and they're in trouble. And I just love how Russell Crowe's character, Jack Aubrey, immediately turns and they're like, what are we going to do? And he goes, run like smoke and oakum, you know? And they're like, oh, well, what, we have enough sails to blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, pull out our pocket handkerchiefs if we have to. We have to survive this day, right? Mm-hmm. And then he looks out and he sees and he goes, this is the second time he's outsmarted me. There won't be a third, right? I just love those pieces, right? It really does lend itself. The dialogue is strong. The technical dialogue also is very, very strong. And, you know, whatever 2003 graphics might kind of take you out slightly in certain places, overall, I do think that it is something that you will suspend your disbelief watching it too. And again, with Star Trek, right? People traveling through space at incredible speeds into weird planets and people with funny prosthetics on their faces to make them look like aliens. I suspend all of that disbelief when I am immersed in a story. So, let's maybe dive into that a little bit. Let's do some comparisons. I want to know some of the thoughts on the values of the Federation versus the, I would say mildly to majorly problematic values of the Royal Navy of 1805. First of all, I would just say those black people on the ship are slaves. England does not abolish slavery until 1840. And even then, they're still not very good to people of color. So that definitely just gets sort of glossed over. Like, you just see black people walking around and there's no real explanation that they are actually slaves. These people are property. And I can't say I'm happy about that. I mean, we could go on to say, like, well, they look like they're treated well. And I would say, yep, but they're still property. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that, what tensions would you say exist between the values of the Federation and the Royal Navy?
Well, I mean, you've outlined a really, really good one there. And I would almost say, given the ideas that Gene Roddenberry had for the source material for Star Trek, the fact that he made very conscious decisions to have a very diverse crew, especially for 1960s standards, on the Enterprise, I think that almost highlights that, or that almost plays that contrast really well. That, yeah, this is a ship akin to a naval ship. And it's not just, you know, white officers and, you know, third class crew down in the engine room of, you know, we're not going to say what origin, you know, but it's, you know, a more equal white male dominated. It is still the 60s, but a lot more diverse crew, especially for that time. So I think that's a big thing. And then writ large, I mean, the Federation fights its wars and has those conflicts, but generally speaking, the mission, right, is we're out there to make peaceful contact with peoples. And you can kind of read that through a lens of colonialism and stuff too. I think Star Trek has its shortcomings in various areas, its blind spots, if you will. But its stated goals and the ethos behind it is definitely of a purer nature, or at least in the minds of its creators, hopefully a much purer kind of origin for that. So there's definitely some big contrasts you can put in there. I just want to jump back to something you said too.
Yeah.
When you were talking about Aubrey's talking about, like, that's the second time he's bested me, there won't be a third. The original series episode Balance of Terror, and this is an episode we're going to come back to a lot. There's a line that went through my head immediately at that point, and I looked it up and I've got the exact line here. So it's the Enterprise is facing off against a Romulan bird of prey, and very similar, right? Like, there's kind of the things where they're chasing them, they disappear in the tail of a comet, all this kind of stuff. And during that, they circle around behind and catch the Enterprise unawares. So they evade just at the last second. And as they get away, Kirk says, "He did exactly what I would have done. I won't underestimate him again." Very similar vibe there. I was like, hey, that sounds very familiar.
And Dr. Maturin says to Aubrey, Aubrey's going, you know, why is this French captain so obsessed with me? Did I kill a relative in battle? His son, God forbid? And then he just turns and is like, no, he fights like you, Jack. He fights like you.
And exactly.
I love that, yeah, there is a lot of connective tissue between the canonical Captain Kirk from TOS and Jack Aubrey. Jack Aubrey isn't as much of a ladies' man, I suppose, but yeah, he's got that plan. Everything's got a plan, and you know he doesn't like to lose, and neither does Jack Aubrey in that respect as well. So maybe kind of pulling on that thread instead, I was going to go on to a different question, but I'm gonna stick to this right now. If we were to think of Balance of Terror and the French captain being the Romulan captain, and then Captain Kirk being Jack Aubrey, in this respect, could we then maybe say that we're also kind of looking at the concept of the enemy's story is a lot like mine, mm-hmm. right? Notice how every time Jack Aubrey looks with his telescope at the French ship, the first thing he sees is the captain of the French ship looking at him with his telescope. And I can't help but, again, the command performance of and suddenly the name escapes me of the Romulan captain.
Mark Leonard.
Yeah, of Mark Leonard's performance as the Romulan captain. I can't help but again sort of feel the idea that the two men are sort of in a weird sense of dialogue with their game of cat and mouse, that there is a respect there, right? I know Mark Leonard's character does say some pretty good things about Captain Kirk throughout, and obviously Kirk sort of gives him some backhanded compliments, and he did exactly what I would do, right? These kinds of things.
He's a sorcerer, that one, the Romulan commander says at one point. Yeah,
exactly. So I think maybe kind of highlighting this idea that with this battle, with this fight, also kind of comes a certain level of respect between these two men locked in mortal combat. And again, something very much that we see in Star Trek. One thing I was going to mention is, despite his arrogance, I do think Gul Dukat has a certain level of respect for Captain Sisko.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Perhaps a love even.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. Going back to the Romulan commander just for 1 minute, though.
Yeah.
The final line before, or the final scene before he destroys his ship rather than have it be taken by the Federation. "I regret that we meet in this way. You and I are of a kind. In a different reality, I could have called you a friend." Brilliant. Like, that's it right there. And I got that very much from Captain Aubrey and the French captain as well. on a different level, maybe, but given what happens at the end. But interesting, for sure. You make a really good point about Gul Dukat and Sisko as well, and especially, in those early seasons. Very much the counterpart to Sisko, and the kind of... From the very first time we see him, right? He's like, "Oh, a week ago, this was my office." Just that kind of battle of wits between the two of them, and even working together a few times over the course of the series.
Yeah.
But always that wary kind of antagonistic relationship, but also one of respect. Like, you wouldn't take Sisko as seriously as Dukat does if he didn't respect him. Exactly. And on some level, vice versa as well.
Yeah. One other point, and, you know, kind of getting into the initial battle takes place in the nebula version on the ocean of the, you know, sighting in fog. Mm-hmm. The idea that they start realizing that the Acheron, this French ship, isn't actually just going about its business privateering. It's after the surprise. They want to take down the surprise because they don't want to have any kind of opposition whatsoever, right? So the idea that they're actually being fought, I think of Khan, right? When he's talking about how far he'll go to take on Kirk and to destroy Kirk, right? There is something personal about it as well. And that dogged pursuit, right? And then that's reflected as well when Jack Aubrey almost kills his entire crew going through the Horn of South Africa, or South America. Mm-hmm. In this, we see that those same obsessions being brought out in Star Trek characters quite often. So that's a cool little piece here. The next thing I want to ask, though, and maybe this is kind of a larger, broader question to sort of jump to, but though the Federation is intercultural, it's interplanetary, it shapes its identity through the fact that it builds more, right? Diversity being something that they admire in a maybe non-hegemonic way, or maybe there is a form of hegemony there. Is the Federation still as expansionist as the Royal Navy and the British Empire would be, would you say?
That's a bit of an interesting question. Are they as expansionist? Maybe, but not through the same means, if that makes sense. So if you take a character like Michael Eddington, he would definitely argue that the Federation is very much expansionist, calling them worse than the Borg. At least the Borg tell you your plans for assimilation. The Federation just, you know, will influence you until you join, and they don't even realize that they're being assimilated and stuff. I mean, I think I take a slightly less cynical view of the Federation than that, but there is definitely a, I would say almost a belief. If you're in the Federation and you believe in it and champion it, there's a belief that one day the entire galaxy will be happy under the flag of the Federation, and everyone will be, you know, happy and chummy joining the Federation. Not through force of arms, though. So maybe as expansionist, but not in the same manner, if that makes sense.
A doe-eyed expansionism, perhaps?
Yeah.
So the reason why I asked this question is...
unassuming, maybe non-threatening expansionism. Be our friends.
Right? Well, I think to some degree, this is what most citizens of the United Kingdom of that time would have believed. And in fact, I would say up to my grandma's generation. Now, I come from a sort of a mixture of Irish and English stock. But on my mum's side, on my mum's side, they're very British. love the Queen. You know, we go, the whole family cried when Princess Diana passed away. A lot of stuff there, right? Mm-hmm. But I do recall my grandmother very much, who I spent a lot of time with, and she really means a lot to me. She did kind of express a certain doe-eyed belief that the British were always, their intentions were always better, you know, and that all they wanted was good trade relationships with the people they encountered, and of course that was always important, but sometimes they got nasty and had to be nasty back, you know, and it's this thought of maybe to some degree the fairy tale of Star Trek, or maybe the conceit of Star Trek and the Federation, is that you could be that expansionist, incorporating other groups into this alliance system that you have without having to be kind of hegemonic from time to time, right? I think about some of the economic alliances that exist in the world today, right? You know, we're kind of looking at the toss-up between military versus economic alliances. You know, you've got North American Free Trade Agreement like NAFTA or BRICS, which has come out. And I think despite the well-intentioned means of any of these sorts of things, there does have to be a certain level of who's in charge and who's going to be calling the shots here and, you know, that sort of stuff. So this is something that I think we as Star Trek lovers can maybe kind of brush aside and say, well, no, the Federation is well-intentioned and good. But I am glad that we have had Eddingtons come along to maybe pop mm-hmm. that bubble a little bit. And for the new Star Trek series coming out, I would be really interested to see how they pursue the re-expansion of the Federation, or what exactly that's going to look like, how it's going to play itself out, and what sorts of contradictions we might run ourselves into. Because at the end of Master and Commander, they're headed to Valparaiso, which is a city in Chile, a city that was at the time occupied by the British. It was not willfully occupied because the British had taken it from the Spanish, who had taken it from the indigenous people who were originally living there. Mm-hmm. And so in this respect, I do think that maybe watching shows like this can give us the maybe darker history that Star Trek draws itself from. And I mean, I don't say that with any kind of specific, you know, wag of the finger or anything like that, but I think it is important to know that we are still looking at things through certain lenses, and that mm-hmm. Western centric lens does lend itself to the Star Trek franchise. So I think recent Star Trek series have really done a good job of actually starting to really break that down, but the fossilization, the fingerprints are still there.
Yeah, well, I'm sure the Federation post-burn, as they seek to reestablish themselves, will merely do things to, you know, bring civilization to the worlds that have lost it, and be greeted as liberators. And what other euphemisms can I run down the list? Yeah, there definitely is that danger, right, of embracing that expansionist mindset, and I think a lot of what built Star Trek and the idea of it, like I talked a little bit about what went into the DNA of Star Trek. Another big part of the DNA of Star Trek that we didn't talk much about was the Western, right?
Yes.
And the bringing civilization to the frontier, maybe just one slight small step away from manifest destiny, bringing the message of the Federation to the stars, right? It gets into some dangerous territory there for sure.
Absolutely. So maybe kind of narrowing this back down to the movie itself, The Surprise. It is a Manowar, one deck, 194 souls at the start of the movie, and considerably fewer by the end of it. But they do get the prize in the end, which is nice. I would argue that much like we fall in love with different ships of the line in Star Trek, this is definitely one of those ships that you kind of fall in love with, and it kind of becomes its own character in a lot of ways. I think about when it had been ravaged by the first Acheron attack, they mentioned this idea that the ship is a little bit old, right? And Jack Aubrey has a little crash out over that, where he says, you know, do I look like I'm past my prime? And, you know, she's got fine lines and, you know, steady sails and all this. And he's kind of rubbing his hand against a portion of the interior deck that's just been completely obliterated by cannon shot. And I could not help but feel very much like when Riker talks about the Defiant, saying she's a tough little ship. And I would say that there is sort of a lovability to the Surprise in a lot of ways. You think about the fact that their mast is actually braced together. There's braces on all sides of it holding their mast together, because at some point they must have had their mast blown down, which is basically like breaking a ship's back. You know, it would be kind of like if, you know, Geordi had to staple the warp core back together or something like that. So in that respect as well, I think there's a bit of a lovability to the ship itself, and watching it as they repair it, as everyone's always busy on it, people live on it, people die on it. And there's even a mention, I think it was Moffat, one of the second or third or fourth in command, says to one of the midshipmen, there's a Jack Aubrey's fought on this ship for so long, there's enough blood on it that his own blood on this ship that he can consider it family. So I don't know, did you find yourself loving the ship, or am I kind of going off on a bit of a tangent here?
No, absolutely. That was definitely baked into the DNA of the movie for sure. And I think I've read the first Patrick O'Brien. I think the first one is Master and Commander. Years ago, I read it, and I remember that feeling of that love for that ship just being an indelible part of that story. And I think they do a good job of working that into the film as well. It's funny, you mentioned Riker saying tough little ship. For me, it was a direct line. Like, it's not even subtext, it's text in the original series, that James T. Kirk loves the Enterprise, that the Enterprise is a personified being to him that he cherishes with his entire being. Like when they get the Psi 2000 alcohol virus thing, and they're all admitting their deepest feelings, and Spock's crying about his mother in the briefing room, Kirk starts crying about the Enterprise and that he'll never lose her, and he loves her. You know, like that was such a huge part of that character that, again, I think Gene Roddenberry must have taken directly from. I've not read Horatio Hornblower, but I imagine it was a very similar type thing there. So yeah, I think they did that very well in the film, and it was very evocative of a lot of what we see in Star Trek for sure.
To kind of put a bow on that, I remember Aubrey's little speech he does to the crew below decks. As the Acheron is approaching, they've disguised their ship to look like a whaler to bring the Acheron in close, because that's the only way they're going to beat it. They're a considerably smaller ship. And I remember him saying, you know, like, though we be on the far side of the world, this is our home. This ship is England. And I remember thinking very much like, you know, if I was in this scenario, and I've kind of, you know, we've been dropped in at this point, we love members of the crew. We've really invested in this movie at this point. I just thought to myself, I'm like, oh yeah, no, I'd fight to the death now. Like, unquestionably, I would fight very, very hard for this ship. And of course, he kind of, with a little wink at the end, says, and of course, Surprise is on our side. And again, that kind of, that little wry piece that I think connects the personality of the captain to the ship, right?
Yeah.
Every time Jack Aubrey has some cockamamie plan to do something, this or that and the other thing, everyone looks surprised, but then you'll always see one of his, you know, officer class will kind of let a little smile out as everyone's sort of surprised, right? And then it is that idea that, you know, they're going around the horn and they say, you know, no, Jack knows the ship. He knows what she can take. You know, again, it sounds very much like something a character on the Enterprise would say about Kirk if they were going through some kind of gravimetric dispersal or something like that, right?
Yeah, I think Sulu's given that little smirk a few times when Kirk's going to do some maneuver, right?
Yeah.
He kind of looks over at whoever the navigator of the week was before Chekhov came aboard and just gives a little wry smile. The other thing that made me think of, and I don't usually give Voyager a lot of credit, but that one line where, you know, though we be on the far side of the world, this ship is home. This ship is England. There's a little bit in the, I think it's the final episode, actually, the series finale of Voyager, where Harry Kim is desperately trying to convince people that, no, we need to do this Borg conduit thing and get home. You know, we have to get home. And Tom Paris, who's now married to B'Elanna Torres, who's carrying their child and is going to give birth soon, says to Harry, I am home. And then, like, that's the end of the conversation. Like, the ship is home. Like, that's home. I love that. And kudos to Voyager. I don't give Voyager a lot of kudos, but I love that line was very memorable to me.
That's an extremely good point. And yeah, kudos to Voyager. As a non-Voyager completionist, that again just kicks me in the pants that I need to get around to that.
We should do that. We should watch Voyager together. It's only 7 seasons of 26 episodes each, right? We'll blow through that.
Light work.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Positively Trek comes to you each week thanks to the efforts of our amazing Patreon members. If you'd like to help support the show, simply visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. Join at any level to get early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive content. For higher tiers, we offer shoutouts, associate producer credits, and more. We appreciate each and every one of our listeners. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Live long and prosper.
Well, we're kind of moving through the sort of scattered plan I created. So I think I want to move on, maybe delving down to we've kind of been sort of dipping into characters and stuff like that. And I think one of the biggest things that we have to start with is Aubrey and Dr. Maturin. So Jack Aubrey, Dr. Maturin, clearly are friends before all of this. I do remember in the books, they like met somewhere at like a port in the Caribbean or whatever. And I think they started by having an argument or something and then they made friends. I mean, it's a bromance to end all bromances in a lot of ways. But I think where we kind of get that similarity, and again, as Star Trek fans, what we might find interesting is Aubrey, we've already established, is very Kirk-like, right? With a bit of Picard in him, I'd say. Actually, no, he's Kirk and Sisko, if I think about it. Not as diplomatic. He's good for a fight, but he knows his crew and he knows his ship. But I would say that Maturin, who is played by Paul Bettany, who was actually in WandaVision, if I remember correctly, and he was the voice of Jarvis. Yes. As well. There we are. There's my brain kicking in. He's sort of a mixture. Now you've said a lot that, you know, he's very McCoy-esque, and I would say he's more McCoy, but there's a bit of Spock in there too, in that seriousness, in his ability to kind of like raise an eyebrow at all of this Navy stuff that everyone's doing, kind of, actually, I'm apart from you all. And that's something that I find Spock does quite a bit, where he's like, and here's where I set myself apart. Like when
you humans and your predilection for violence or
right?
Whatever, right?
Yeah. I remember in Master and Commander when they're finally getting around the Horn of South America and they see that the, what's his face? The Mr. Bonden, the guy who drives the ship, is turning the rudder, and you can see the rudder's internal mechanism is moving, and they're watching. They go, oh, and then yay, and they're all cheering. And he turns and he's like, I imagine something wonderful and nautical has just happened, right? And they're like, we're headed back north, Steve. Like, get happy. We're not going to be cold anymore, right? I love that kind of... It's not Spock-esque in the sense that, like, Spock would never feign ignorance, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But in the sense of, like, I am not like you. I am not one of you. And I think Maturin's criticisms of the Royal Navy and the way it operates as well, I think, lends itself very much. For those of you who don't know, most of the people you see on that ship in real life would have been press-ganged into becoming sailors, meaning they would have told their wife or their family, I'm headed to the pub, I'll be back in an hour. And then they went to the pub and were bullied into joining the Navy, basically. They would be press ganged. So typically they'd finish their ale or whatever they were drinking, and oh, inside there'd be a coin. And if you drank an entire drink with a coin in it with the head of the king, that means you have pledged your allegiance to the king and are now a member of the Royal Navy. And off you would go to Chatham, where you would be put on a ship and sent out to sea, and that's that. So most of these guys are actually not volunteers. Now, there were volunteers, don't get me wrong, 100%. And not everyone had to sail on a ship. Sometimes you were press-ganged into working in the rope factory or something and whatever else. But I do think that his criticisms give him a bit of a Spock-esque, I'm better than you kind of feel. But I'm going to let you talk about the McCoy stuff, because you had a lot to say about that, and I appreciated your insights, because he is more McCoy than he is Spock.
Well, I don't know. You make a really good case there, and there is definitely a lot of Spock. And I can't help but notice the name Maturin, right? Like, he's maybe, from the perspective of the author, a little bit more mature than the rest of the crew, too, as well, right? But yeah, he also definitely screams Dr. McCoy to me. Obviously, he's the ship's surgeon and all of that stuff, but that relationship with Jack Aubrey that he has, again, like, Balance of Terror is one that I keep coming back to, where in that episode, Kirk and Bones have that conversation, right? Where he's the one person on the ship that Captain Kirk can show a little bit of vulnerability to and a little bit of wavering about, right? On the deck of the ship, as on the bridge of the Enterprise, the captain is the captain, and he projects nothing but confidence, because to do any less is to doom your crew, basically. But in the privacy of his quarters with McCoy, right, he has that conversation, what if I'm wrong? And McCoy has that great speech, which doesn't really connect to this film, but I still love this speech where McCoy is at a bit of a loss of what to say. And just as Kirk's leaving, he stops Kirk and says, Captain, and Kirk interrupts him. No, I don't really expect an answer. And Bones says, but I've got one. Something I seldom say to a customer, Jim. In this galaxy, there's a mathematical probability of 3 million Earth-type planets. And in all of the universe, 3 million galaxies like this. And in all of that, and perhaps more, only one of each of us. Don't destroy the one named Kirk. No bearing on this movie whatsoever. I just love that line. But similarly, Aubrey and Maturin have that kind of relationship where he's still the captain. He's still very confident, but he does allow a little bit of a crack in that facade when it comes to dealing with Dr. Maturin. And Dr. Maturin can see that and knows that and knows his friend. And they have some great drag out screaming matches at each other where they are very much at odds, but at the same time, he's always that counselor that the captain needs, or that sounding board that the captain needs. And I love that relationship, and it played out so well in the film.
Yeah. And I do think that Dr. Maturin also basically spends most of his time saying, damn it, Jack, I'm a doctor, not a fighter. Right.
And I do also have to admit, briefly, when you described him as a naturalist, I imagined him walking around the ship naked. But that means that's something else. That's not naturalist.
Well, I mean, when they got stuck in the gyre, I'm sure people got up to some silly crap. Because when you get bored, I mean, who knows what happens, right?
For sure.
But I want to talk a bit about some of the members of the crew. I'm not going to mention them all. And there are a lot of really great great characters who don't analog their way very well into the bridge of the Enterprise. But if I was to start, Mr. Lam, who is kind of the guy who knows how the ship was built and knows how to, plug the holes and fix the mast and kind of do those bigger pieces. He is the Geordi, Scotty, and O'Brien, I find, in a lot of ways.
He can turn rocks into replicators.
Exactly. Or the Torres, right? And I think for that, my favorite piece there is when the ship is kind of sinking at the start and they're really in a lot of trouble. I remember he turns and I forget the exact measurement he gives, but he's something like 10 inches and holding, right? And you know, there's that moment where Aubrey's like, I knew I could count on you, right? And then later, you know, he's like, I don't think the mast is going to make it around the horn. And he's like, your concern has been noted, right? It's very Scotty, right? Mm-hmm. Out of the ship, I don't think she can take it, Captain, you know, that kind of thing. And he's like, noted, Scotty, off we go, right? We're going to keep doing this. Yeah. I like that.
I'll fix it for you, and it'll take 8 weeks to fix, but I'll do it for you in 2.
Yeah, kind of. Precisely.
Yeah. I've got to put the 8 weeks in the official log, but we can do it in 2.
Yeah. I think that the kind of cavalier way he plays himself, Lieutenant Pullings, the first mate of the ship, who served a lot with Jack Aubrey beforehand and stuff, he's very Riker-y, right? He's young, he's you know, like I said, he's cavalier, right? When they go to fight the French finally and they jump onto their ship, he literally just jumps on like 6 guys, just gets right into it. He's got a scar on his face. You know, he's down there with the men. You can tell he's loved, but you can also tell, you know, he's probably a little hot-headed, right? He could get into some trouble if he didn't have such a strong captain beside him. And I think there would be a desire to stay with that captain as well, even after his lovely promotion at the end, but I won't tell you why. I think also one of my favorites, though, is the one who flies the ship, the Chekhov of the ship, I guess. And he was also a hobbit in Lord of the Rings, Mr. Bonden, who basically flies the Surprise. I think one of my favorite bits of him is his teeth are horrifying. They put him into makeup to make his teeth look horrifying. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, too, because that's how their teeth would have actually looked. Like when he's clenching his teeth, you're like, oh, man, you got to smile like a broken window, man. it's something else. But he's also really good at what he does. Like when Captain Aubrey realizes that, or not realizes, but plans it out that they're going to kind of get the drop on the Acheron. He's like, all right, that's enough easting. Now make a course south by southwest. And he's like, aye, sir. South by Southwest, right? He knows what's going to happen, right? He knows how this is going to work. And his eyes are really good, right? He can see really, really far on the horizon and all that sort of stuff. So again, mm-hmm. I see that idea that you could just plop him in, well, depending on the era, in a, I guess a command uniform and throw him at the con and he'd know how to fly that thing nice and easy.
Maybe like Travis Mayweather, a boomer on the NX-01 or something.
Oh yeah, he throws some Mayweather vibes. That's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
And by boomer, Enterprise. I should say the space boomer, not the current definition of boomer.
Heavens.
Yeah, I recently rewatched an Enterprise episode and they referred to him as a boomer, and I was like, oh, that word has taken a different meaning since last I watched this.
That didn't age well. Yeah, are there any characters that connect well for you? I'm kind of maybe catching you off guard, but you know, are there any characters that you would say would sit really well on the Enterprise bridge?
Well, maybe I think you did a really good job of the kind of specific ones, but my mind also went to a lot of the characters that we see that aren't, you know, the officers, but the kind of lower decker crew members.
Yeah.
And I think you might know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Definitely got the, you know, lower decks vibes a little bit. Maybe not as wacky hijinks as they get up to on the Cerritos. It's a little bit darker. It's a little bit more dire than the Cerritos. But I definitely got that, you know, there's the officers and then there's the lower deckers. It was you know, the upstairs downstairs version of the Navy, right? Kind of thing. Yeah. So
even by way of the food they eat.
Yes, absolutely. They don't get the macaroni with the nice crust below decks, for sure. No.
They get slop.
Yes, very
but
much
I,
so.
But I will say, in my research, they got about 6,000 calories a day of hardtack, salted beef. They would get 2 cups of oatmeal. Like, that ship was also full of food. Like, so much food.
They needed it.
Oh, did they ever, right? Yeah. All that climbing. Like, they were barefoot climbing those ropes up onto the mizzens and everything. And, like, I think that's another thing, you know, like, you and I being near Edmonton, right? We've all been to West Edmonton Mall and looking at that mock-up, silly mock-up of the Santa Maria. It's not accurate by any full stretch of the imagination, but you know, if you think about a ship like that, like, it would be so busy. There'd be people everywhere climbing that thing like a upturned anthill. It would be just wild to see one of those things in actual action. And I have to say, shout out, I don't even know if he listens, but friend Bryson, who is of Mi'kmaq heritage, he actually did serve on a sailing vessel for a short period of time as an able seaman, I think, if I remember correctly.
It was the same ship that they used as the Enterprise in Generations. Am I remembering that correctly?
Maybe. I interviewed him on Polytrex many, 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 many years ago.
And, yeah, we had him on Positively Trek as well, and he talked, I thought that's what he'd said, but I might be misremembering that.
Well, massive shout out to Bryson, even if he isn't listening. If you can find him on the socials, he is well worth a follow. A very interesting, extremely intelligent fellow who knows his sailing stuff. He actually used to do little sailing lessons and stuff on social media too. He was he's a pretty cool person. So if you can find him, folks, he's worth a follow for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so a little love out there to Bryson. Moving on, though, let's maybe kind of get into some final kind of analogs and maybe kind of come up with a finishing volley, they might say. And kind of starting that off, when I watch TNG, I always get a little bit miffed by the lack of tactics and movement when the ships just come at each other like Rock'em Sock'em robots and just start shooting back and forth. After doing a fair bit of research, however, I've realized that that's how naval ships fought back in the day. They get right up close to each other and just fire cannons until one side struck its colors or sank. And getting hit by these cannons, it was interesting. We did this movie with my students, actually, and they were saying, like, well, you know, like a cannonball, like, that wouldn't necessarily hurt. You know, like, get out of the way of the cannonball and be fine. And then a couple of other students said, it's not the cannonball you have to worry about. It's when that large sphere bowling ball sized hunk of iron goes through the oak and sends thousands of splinters moving just about supersonic speed in every direction, like a shotgun blast. That's what gets you, right? That's the thing that's going to harm you. And so you imagine being below decks, loading these cannons, firing them off. It's loud, and there's giant chunks of splinters flying everywhere. People are screaming. What a chaotic place. And, you know, thinking about the Enterprise ships with the rocks falling and people lying and blowing up and flying over their consoles, again, I can really see where the influence finally comes from. And I know we have now retconned those rocks into reality. Thank you, Lower Decks.
The country rocks.
Yeah, exactly. I have to say, though, it's... it is, again, this is the heritage, this is the pedigree, this is where it comes from, is ships would get right up close to each other, and they would just blast each other until they hit their powder magazine. In this case, for Star Trek, it's the warp core, and then boom, she goes up. In fact, Lord Nelson, who gets mentioned a lot in the movie, who sadly would have died in the duration of that movie. The Battle of Trafalgar, I would say, arguably happens in the timeline of that movie where Lord Nelson finally dies. He gets sniped, I think, by a musket on the mizzen of an opponent's ship, and the bullet goes down his spine and into his liver. And he dies slowly. But the interesting part is, like a good ship's captain, he refuses service. He's like, I know I'm going to die, so let me die. Let me be comfortable and tend to people who you know you can save. I'm a lost cause. And he was right. He died. So yeah, I think that's one of my favorite analogies, is the idea that battle is actually a lot closer than I originally thought. And I'm going to stop criticizing TNG for its depiction of battle, because it's kind of accurate.
I think if this is kind of an aside and not really related to as seen in this film, but the unfortunate thing is, if space battles were done the way that they probably actually would be, you know, the enemy ships would never even see each other. I mean, barring nebulas, which aren't actually like they are in Star Trek, they're very, like, if you're in the middle of a nebula, it would just look like space. There's nothing really going to be in your way. You can see things very, 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 very far off. Like, presumably a society at the technological level of the Federation would know when something is entering Earth's solar system years before it got to the solar system. Like, it was just like, there it is. It's still coming. It's coming.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe warp drive would change that a little bit. The Star Trek, you know, two ships kind of just pummeling each other at close quarters, it's always been a little bit whatever, but I see where they're going for with the naval analogies.
Unintentional accuracy.
Yeah, absolutely. I do love this idea of scene analogs. And one thing that you'd mentioned earlier too is the busyness of the ship, right? Of the Surprise. Mm-hmm. Things coming and going and happening on the deck at all times. That's something I always really appreciated about Star Trek, the original series, that in a lot of ways didn't carry forward so much into the later generations and the later shows, where there was always business going on. So like, they'd show shots of the corridor and people would be walking down the corridor and there'd be somebody in an environmental suit carrying something and going from one door to the other. And there'd be people lowering things down a little access shaft down the ladder and stuff. And on the bridge, you know, Kirk is consulting with Spock and McCoy, and a yeoman walks up and hands her a report, you know, fuel consumption report or something for him to, you know, he's carrying on the conversation. He looks briefly, reads it, signs, hands it back, and goes on about the dialogue in the episode. I loved that stuff. It just felt very real. It felt like a very real place. That's not to say the later shows don't feel real to me, but I feel like anytime they introduce that little bit of lived in atmosphere, that I think this film did very, very well. And I mean, I would point to maybe an episode like For the Uniform from Deep Space Nine, where the Defiant is disabled and a lot of the systems aren't working. So they're, you know, doing things a lot more manually than they would normally. Sisko's calling out the orders down to engineering on the bridge, and Nog has the little intercoms, you know, bridge, engineering, bridge, more power to the starboard interlock, engineering reports, power on the way, sir, you know, and like, right thruster, 15%, 2 second burst now, you know, like all that stuff. I'm like, oh, I love that. It doesn't make sense to reintroduce that into Star Trek now, because they're so far beyond that. But gosh, I miss that stuff.
That was a delight. And that actually is one of my favorite episodes. And yeah, the Nog's acting very, very much like you hear, right? Like the sand and broken shell, right? It's that absolutely. No, that's a great piece. One other piece that I like about the crew doing cool stuff was when the two ships, the just seamen, show up. One of them's a ship's carpenter. I forget the other guy, but he spends a lot of time in the sails. He's on the mizzens quite a lot. Turns out that he saw the Acheron before it was finished its completion, and because his buddy's a ship's carpenter, he puts it together. Right? He describes it. Yeah, and I could just, I mean, for me, the switch over to like a crewman walking up to Sisko on the Defiant with a PADD and being like, I drummed up a schematic for you, sir, to this and that, and then there is the little 3D graphics with a bunch of Elcars around it, right? Again, there's that same idea of, you know, these crew crewmen are not simply just doing their jobs. They're keen, right? And then, you know, they're little Boimlers going around trying to figure out cool things to do and all that sort of stuff. I loved that. And then when Jack Aubrey sees this model and he's like, this is true. And he's like, yes, this is true. And he looks and he's like, oh, look at the way it does all these shippy things that I can't exactly quote, but he turns and he just goes, what a marvelous modern age we live in, you know? And it's funny because obviously that was put in there to make everybody chuckle. But like, again, a Star Trek-y style of saying things, right? Like, oh, what technology and blah, 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 that sort of stuff. It's it lends itself well. And I think the other really great part, and just in that scene again, the ship is rocking back and forth all the time, and so is the camera. I can imagine watching this on IMAX or something. I might get seasick watching it go back and forth. Much like in TNG, unless the ship was like actually stopped for a reason, the stars would be moving in the background, either at warp or at impulse or whatever. And it's those little details, those little tiny details that, again, just help bring you in, right? You've got crew who are doing things in earnest, right? They're interested in helping. They're part of the crew, even if they're a lower rank. And the ship is doing ship things while all of that's happening. Those analogs just really, really come in for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of that ship business. I like your mention of the stars moving in the background. That's a really good point and kind of an analog to what we see here. Another thing I just recently saw, there's a gentleman by the name of Jorg Hillebrand, I think his name is, and he mm-hmm. does a great job of going through every episode and finding like all these little minute details, like this prop was first seen in this episode and it's redressed to be this and that. And I recently saw a post by him where there's a scene in engineering on the Enterprise D and they have that plexiglass wall around the warp core, and in this scene, the camera is only ever facing in that direction, and Geordi's having a scene or something, and then he gets up with the whoever he's talking to and walks across. And as the camera pans across the plexiglass window, you can see a reflection of the like pool table in the middle of engineering, as they called it. And there's mm-hmm. somebody working on there. They're not in the scene. They're reflected in the scene, and they're never like actually on camera. It's just you see their reflection as they walk by for a split second, and it's just this little thing that you probably don't even clock when you're watching, but it just there's a layer of realism there that you know, even when there's, you know, you're not paying an extra to be actually on direct camera, they're there hitting buttons on a panel behind the camera as they film this scene. That's brilliant. I love that.
And if I was that extra, I'd be hitting the crap out of those buttons, man. Because that's it's those little intricacies, those little tiny attention to detail-y moments that, I mean, you didn't notice it, but your brain did, I think Red Letter Media would say. And I agree very much that those little tiny details are what actually make the film. The devil is always in the details, right?
Makes the Enterprise real.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. I think maybe the last bit that I would really want to dive into is, though I would argue it's not done as well in Star Trek, music is done very well in Master and Commander, right? When they're toasting each other and they're, now we're safe ashore, Jack, don't forget your old shipmates, folly, rolly, 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 rio. You know, I can't help but sing along every time. Every time I hear that song, I get into it, and it's almost as good as the Last of Barrett's Privateers, which I need to brush up on my lyrics. I don't know them all as I used to, but I think that Star Trek has attempted it in the past, and it's been hit and miss, I would say, in a lot of cases, the use of music in Trek, singing especially. The only one I will give time to is Melota, but that's a joke between you and me.
I think for me, unless it's Uhura or Klingons on a Klingon ship singing, it's kind of in Star Trek.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, if it's Nichelle Nichols, give it to me. And yeah, if it's the Klingons, then it really is. But in their version, be like, right? That kind of stuff. It's totally great. Beautiful.
I just love Soldiers of the Empire when they're finally, Martok has found his bravery and they're going to go after the Klingon ship and it's set course for the blah, blah, blah. And then just one guy in the background just starts thump, 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 hitting the console and they start breaking up. Like, ah, that's great.
Well, and there you have it, right? There's the connection that Star Trek does so well. Well, I think ultimately, and maybe to kind of put a final piece on my end, at least, is just the idea that I really do think that this entire movie could have its screenplay rewritten in a Trek skin, and it wouldn't skip a beat. You could put Janeway as the captain, and throw her into a very similar situation, and I feel like we would have a just as compelling movie, just as compelling story, right? As long as they felt with the same beats, and I don't feel like this is something that's necessary. I think Master and Commander stands on its own, but I think to be able to place a captain and a crew into this kind of a story, you would have just as good of a story, same compelling, you know, aspects to it, same interplay of emotions and circumstance and everything else, and take us to, you know, the same kind of beats that we saw in this movie. And I think maybe that's why Master and Commander, I think, does stand as a really positive surrogate of Star Trek. And maybe, or maybe not, I don't know. I don't know what Peter Weir had to think about this, or the writers, or any of the actors, or anyone in the movie whatsoever, if anyone was a Star Trek fan. But for what it's worth, I do have to say, we as Star Trek fans are allowed to adopt this one. I think this is our movie too, and we can have it. Maybe there are Star Wars and other science fiction movies that connect to, you know what? Star Wars can have Lord of the Rings. There you go. Have the whole franchise. That's yours. We get Master and Commander. That's what I would say to kind of finish off my thoughts on this.
Well, with the recent talk coming out of the Star Trek crews of Kate Mulgrew having been approached or in talks to return as Janeway again, maybe we'll get Master and Commander the Far Side of the Galaxy with
Far Side of the Janeway. Delta Quadrant. There you go. That would be Kate, if you're listening, and I'm guessing you're probably not, push for this. I would love to see you.
That's definitely what's coming.
Yeah, there we are. Predictions are in, folks. I think it's important for us to know the legacy that our Trek fandom draws itself from. Warts and all, just like those seafaring iguanas on the Galapagos Island. We have a great pedigree, I think, and I think we have a great deal of honor in that pedigree. And we can definitely link hands with people who are reading riling tales of swashbuckling stories on the high seas in the 19th century, just like people would be watching, you know, the exploits of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy in the 1960s all the way to now. So, you know, if you get a chance, Dan and I would highly recommend that you get out there and watch this movie for the enjoyment and for the nostalgia of being like, yep, yeah, this is fossilized Trek.
Absolutely. I like that. Fossilized Trek. I've been slowly adding to the list of possible titles for this episode, and I think Fossilized Trek will have to go on the list here.
Wonderful. Well, folks, that's all I think from the two of us for today, but not quite all. If you are a supporter on Patreon, you're going to get to hear yours truly regale you with his own log as one of the crewmen of the Surprise, talking about aspects of what happens in the film. So if you are a Patreon supporter, you can check your Patreon shortly, I'm guessing. I don't know how Patreon works. So you can check your Patreon, and there you will find yours truly doing an account as the bosun's mate from the Surprise. But if not, feel free to check out our Patreon and join, even just to listen to my lovely, lovely recitation. So with that, I've been Barry DeFord and continue to be, and Dan, I think you continue to be Dan Gunther, I suppose.
I think so. I'll have to check the tag on my underwear, but I think that's correct, yes.
Fair enough. Well, we hope you all enjoy yourselves either in deep space or the high seas, and as always, stay positive.
Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.